I am Plunt on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Michael Vandenbos joins me again. He's got a number of terrific events upcoming that I'll get him to preview for us. Next Sunday, the 13th of December, the afternoon begins at the Cinematheque at 1 p.m. when he'll introduce a screening of Charlie Chaplin's Gold Rush. Then he'll go a few blocks over to the Van City Theatre, where he'll present That's Life, a Frank Sinatra centennial celebration at 3 p.m., featuring extracts from Sinatra's prolific film and television career. That's followed by a 5:30 screening of From Here to Eternity, which garnered Sinatra a Best Supporting Actor Oscar and revived his career, which had hit a slump as the 1950s began. Then Monday night at 6:30, he'll host a screening of Pal Joey that starred Sinatra, Rita Hayworth, and Kim Novak. We'll reflect on Sinatra, his life and legacy. Michael's an ideal guy to talk to, as he's a true Sinatra-phile. Other appearances Mr. Vandenbos will be making this month include his presentation Singing in the Dark, a compilation of dance on film that screens at the Van City Theatre on Sunday, the 20th of December at 3 p.m.
Actually, Joe, that's Singing on Film.
Singing on Film, pardon me.
Yeah, dance would have been my Dancing in the Dark series. Singing in the Dark is featuring great vocal song performances in the movies.
I see. And then Monday, the 28th of December, he'll host a screening of The Searchers at the Cinematheque, viff.org, and thecinematheque.ca for tickets and information. Michael Vandenbos is a film historian and an instructor in the School of Motion Picture Arts at Capilano University. MichaelVDB.ShawWebSpace.ca is his website. Please welcome back to the Plunt Online program, Michael Vandenbos. Mr. Vandenbos, good morning.
Hello there. Thanks for having me back on, Joe. It's a pleasure.
It's always nice to talk to you, and especially about Sinatra, which is a subject that both of us, I guess, have come to know quite well over the years.
Well, if you love Sinatra, you're a man of great taste.
Yeah, I was just thinking the other day about, because everybody's talking about Sinatra at his 100th anniversary of his birth. There wasn't anybody like him before or since, and nobody dominated the entertainment world like he did. I mean, so if you had to, say, figure out what makes a star, I mean, certainly fame, longevity, output, he had all that, didn't he?
Oh, in spades, absolutely. There was nobody like him before and nobody like him afterwards. He had that special it about him, that star quality, which of course many actors and actresses and singers and such have that, but there was something very distinctive and unique about Frank that no one else could even touch. And so much of that had to do with a bigger-than-life personality, without a doubt, but also an artistry deep within him, and a sensitivity to his own emotions that he could utilize and bring to the surface in his interpretation of great American songs and also in his acting as well. He was an instinctual artist. He wasn't trained. He wasn't trained as a singer. He wasn't trained as an actor, but he just had it in him. And it's interesting because he was the first true media superstar who encompassed singing and acting. I guess you could say Charlie Chaplin, and I'm going to be introducing the Gold Rush at the Cinematheque, speaking of Chaplin, but he was maybe perhaps the first great film star, an international star. But with Sinatra, it was the singing that really got him in the limelight. And when he was such a hit with the Bobby Soxers in the 40s, that phenomenal outpouring of love and affection and desire that especially the young Bobby Soxers had for him, there had been nothing like that before. Of course, years later, we saw it with Elvis Presley and the Beatles and, you know, maybe somebody like Justin Bieber, for example. However, it was Sinatra that was the first great phenomenon, the great multimedia phenomenon.
And you know, there were singers in his era that sounded, say, a little bit better, like Dick Hames or Bing Crosby. But what they say about Sinatra is his phrasing. I mean, no one could sing a song like he could and sort of act the song that he could, right?
Well, that's very true. I mean, and that's certainly arguable about, you know, technically who's a better singer, you know, Bing Crosby, Dick Hames, Frank Sinatra. But it goes beyond technicality, and you're absolutely right. Part of the uniqueness of Sinatra was the actual phrasing of the lyrics and the notes, how he would bend the note, and on top of that was his diction.
Yeah.
Absolute devotion to the lyric and making sure not only it was heard, but also that it was interpreted in such a way that nobody else had. And Bing Crosby certainly was a big influence on Sinatra, without a doubt. But what Sinatra brought to crooning or popular singing was a sexual charge, an erotic quality that Bing Crosby even didn't quite have in his singing.
Yeah, like I think if Sinatra's later in his career in the 70s, he recorded, say, "Send in the Clowns," the Sondheim song.
Yes.
Maybe this time from a cabaret, and the context of those songs and the shows that they're from are different than the way he performed them. But he added something, an element to it that was just. I mean, maybe this time is a lot more poppy, if you will, a lot more jazzy than say, when you see it in Cabaret, because, I mean, in the character in Cabaret, I guess, was, I can't remember, was she thinking of having an abortion, or she'd already had an abortion?
When Liza Minnelli sings, which song again?
Maybe this time, yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, I know that all too well. No, that's a critical point in the movie when Liza Minnelli, Sally Bowles, realizes, well, maybe she can have or at least attempt a long-term relationship with the character of Brian, played by Michael York. So that song reflects that moment, that feeling in her at that point.
And then when Sinatra does it, it's something totally different.
Yeah.
And it's something just as beautiful.
Oh, absolutely. And, I mean, just going back to Send in the Clowns by Stephen Sondheim, it's, you know, Sinatra recorded only a handful of Sondheim material, and he should have done more, but nevertheless, what he did with Send in the Clowns is just extraordinary. I mean, he's really touching deep down into some sort of emotional core there and brings it out in a very, not only a substantial way emotionally, but in a very subtle presentation as well. But that's the thing with Sinatra, is that he could do the, real up-tempo swingin' ring-a-ding-ding song and give it, you know, just great gusto and life and really mean it. But then there's the other side of him that can do the, you know, sensitive romantic ballads and not making them cloying or sugary sweet, but actually very touching and moving. Then, you know, getting even lower, there's his saloon song, you know, where it's 2:45, there's no one in the place except you and me. I mean, a guy that's down and out, sitting in a bar, getting drunk, because he has faced some unfathomable loss. And there's nobody that could touch that wide spectrum with such artistry and depth like Frank Sinatra.
Yeah. And, you know, you touched on his personal life, I mean, because you have to, because, I mean, that was part of the celebrity, that was part of the, you know, how he was well known. He was so visible, yet so mysterious.
Yes.
I mean, that's amazing for someone, I guess, in that business. That to this day, people want to figure out who he was.
Yeah, which you couldn't. I mean, he was an enormously complex man, and there was a mystique about him, without a doubt. And he was filled with all sorts of contradictions. I mean, at one turn, he could be crude and, I don't know, maybe self-serving. But on the other hand, he was a great philanthropist. And, he gave away millions and millions of dollars and helped people anonymously as well. And he led a tempestuous love life, especially with the beautiful Ava Gardner, whom he left his first wife, Nancy Barbato, for, which didn't put him in good stand with his fans back in the late 1940s, most certainly. And then, of course, there's all the mystery surrounding affiliations with the mob as well, which goes back to his childhood in Hoboken, certainly. And all that added to the air of, maybe a certain dark shadings to him in that particular mystique, which, of course, all colored his artistry, his music, and his acting as well.
Yeah. So, From Here to Eternity, that won him the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. He has a couple of other Oscars, doesn't he?
Well, he won two special Academy Awards. One was a special humanitarian award later in his career, but his first one was for a short film called The House I Live In. And it was just a short film, which he sings in it, and it's about tolerance and acceptance of your fellow human being, and he won a special Academy Award for that. But yes, From Here to Eternity, that was an acting award, Best Supporting Actor for his role of Maggio. He was also nominated for Best Actor in his role as a heroin addict in The Man with the Golden Arm, directed by Otto Preminger, which is going to be one of the dramatic clips I'm going to be showing in my Sinatra celebration show at Van City Theater.
Yeah, so we forget that Sinatra was a great actor. And so I'm curious to know, on Sunday at the Van City Theater, what other clips of his acting career will you be featuring? I mean, the one of my favorite performances is Some Came Running.
Yes, and that came close to being in my show, but I had to make some cuts for time, obviously, because there's just so much good material. And, yeah, he's awfully good in Some Came Running, directed by Vincent Minnelli and co-starring Dean Martin and Shirley MacLaine.
Yeah.
But I'm certainly going to, in terms of his dramatic roles, include a brief clip from Here to Eternity, which, of course, we're showing later on that night, but I have to include a brief clip from that, a clip from The Man with the Golden Arm, and, of course, The Manchurian Candidate from 1962, which is, you know, arguably his best or one of his very best performances, and just a heck of a darn good thriller as well. And then I'm going to show a little clip from Tony Rome, which was the first of his sort of detective roles in the late 1960s. And the other dramatic clip I'm going to show is from his last starring role in a movie called The First Deadly Sin from 1980, co-starring with Faye Dunaway. And he is just, the movie is, it's flawed, but his performance is not. In Layton's career, he could still pull out an extraordinarily poignant performance. So my show is going to be a mix of some of the dramatic clips and also musicals as well. So him singing and dancing in a variety of musicals, and also including some clips from his famous television concert specials from the 60s and through the 1970s as well, to try to just give a bit of an overview of the artistry of the man.
I'll touch on the specials in just a sec, because those
sure.
were huge. But you know, you just mentioned the musicals in the 40s and the sort. I mean, he was part of that whole MGM machine, wasn't he, with Gene Kelly? And
Oh, yes. He got some, well, he had made a few appearances in movies prior to MGM, usually just a quick appearance with Tommy Dorsey and his orchestra,
yeah.
sing a song or two. But then his first appearance in a movie was with any, you know, sort of substance, I suppose, or any length, was Higher and Higher by RKO in the early 40s, in which he plays Frank Sinatra. But, yes, it was when he signed up with MGM, the Tiffany of all the Hollywood movie studios, when he appeared with Gene Kelly in Anchors Away, he got to dance with him, and he could do it. I mean, Kelly was a taskmaster, and he drilled Sinatra in the dance routines, and Sinatra holds up with Kelly. And then they also appeared together in On the Town, so I'll have a clip represented from that movie. And they also did a third musical called Take Me Out to the Ball Game, directed by Busby Berkeley, as well. So, you know, three solid ones there. But then, you know, he made some duds, like The Kissing Bandit. You know, it's
yeah.
it's pretty bad. And even years later, Sinatra told his daughter, I think, to Nancy Sinatra, he said, "Don't let my grandchildren ever see The Kissing Bandit." You know, and he's absolutely right. He would joke about it himself. But certainly those MGM musicals that I had mentioned are all solid. And then later on, after his resurrection in the early 50s, when he came back, you know, he was in Pal Joey, which we're going to be screening
yeah.
as well, and I'll show a clip, and High Society with Bing Crosby, Young at Heart with Doris Day, Robin and the Seven Hoods with Sammy Davis Jr., and Dean Martin in the early 60s, you know, just generally all terrific musicals in their own way.
Yeah, and those Rat Pack movies, too, like Ocean's 11, they did a number of those, didn't they?
Yeah, there was a handful of movies that he did with the so-called Rat Pack, and the most iconic being Ocean's 11. And in that one, that's the entire clan, so that includes
yeah.
Peter Lawford and Joey Bishop, and even Shirley MacLaine had a little cameo role. But then most of the Rat Pack movies was pretty much Frank and Dean and Sammy, like pictures like Four for Texas, Sergeant's Three, for example. And then I'm going to be showing from Robin and the Seven Hoods with Dean and Sammy and Frank, and even Bing Crosby appears in that one. But, yeah, that was a whole particular, you know, popular component and era and mood and feeling of Sinatra's career. But I don't overemphasize it in my show, because it's one small part of his, you know, very vast, legendary career.
And so these television specials, I guess they began when, in the 60s?
Yeah, 1965, A Man and His Music. Prior to that, he had actually had a couple of TV shows in the early 50s and then later in the later 50s, just a variety show, but it just didn't work for him. The small screen was too constricting for someone so larger than life, and he didn't like the grind of putting out these shows, which was a mix of songs and skits and maybe the occasional dramatic sketch as well. But the song performances were always great in those. But what he did with these concert specials was right in his milieu, which was essentially producing event concert programs that were designed for maximum impact to play on people's televisions at home. And it was just all purely about the music and song performance, and they're pretty spectacular.
Yeah, the ratings were huge, and they won Emmys, didn't they?
Yes, indeed, yeah. So he made several through the 60s, through the 70s, and even the early 80s. So I'm going to be representing some of those with a variety of clips, including one remarkable one from, I think it's about 66 or 67, with Sinatra performing with Antonio Carlos Jobim on some bossa nova numbers, and Sinatra was quick to grab on to that new sound, and it's him like a silk glove. And there's a great album that Sinatra produced in the mid-60s, and it's called Francis Albert Sinatra and Antonio Carlos Jobim. And he's singing bossa nova. And some of these are some American standards by Irvin Berlin and Cole Porter that have been arranged in bossa nova sound, and some are actual bossa nova tunes like Corcovado and The Girl from Ipanema.
Yeah.
And Sinatra is just so in the groove of that gently swaying sound that he even said that he had never sung so quietly since he suffered from laryngitis.
Yeah.
But even so, when you hear him on this, it's just gorgeous, gorgeous stuff. So that's going to be represented in my celebration show.
Yeah, so you've got Pal Joey, which you're screening, I guess, on the Monday.
That's correct.
Was that the first time that we saw Sinatra with a raincoat and the hat?
Probably in the movies. There are some record albums with him, you know, donning that particular look. But for all intents and purposes, Pal Joey, that really, on film, established that cool, swaggering Sinatra persona that is so indelible in our minds. He's singing some great Rodgers and Hart tunes in that one. And it doesn't, you know, and it helps that you've got two talented and very beautiful women you're co-starring with, Rita Hayworth and Kim Novak. In fact, Sinatra off a second billing. It goes Rita Hayworth, Frank Sinatra, Kim Novak.
Mm-hmm.
That's a Columbia Pictures musical, so Rita Hayworth was Columbia's big star. And Sinatra had no problem taking second billing and said, I'd love to be in that sandwich between Hayworth and Novak. And I can understand that completely.
Exactly, yeah. This revival in Sinatra interest, I mean, there was a two-hour concert this past weekend on CBS. There was the four-hour documentary on HBO, and then just a score of books that have come out this season. It is the right time to look back at Sinatra because it's the 100th anniversary of his birth, but it is apt, isn't it, that we remember a guy who was so dominant in show business in the 20th century.
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, for me, he's so much a part of my life that, it never goes away. I mean, he's just so significant. He's my favorite singer of all time. I play his music all the time. I reference Sinatra all the time. So just with his 100th anniversary, it's just kind of amped it all up for me to another level. However, it is really fantastic to remind people of the artistry and what he brought to popular singing and to acting, because it's interesting, when I was watching the CBS Grammy special, the 100th anniversary special about Sinatra last night, I took keen interest in that. And it's amazing, though, I'm not surprised, that so many of these superstar recording artists, they can't handle the material that Sinatra did with seeing ease and mastery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm thinking, like, I'm looking at you, Mr. Garth Brooks. You know, so Garth Brooks performing The Lady with the Tramp, oh, man, that was painful. It's funny because I was thinking so many of these artists I'm watching last night in that show, they're singing the words, but they ain't getting the meaning of what Sinatra did. So it just goes to show that Sinatra was such a unique talent and a unique artist that what he pulls off seemingly so easy is very, very difficult to do. That's because Sinatra was a craftsman. I mean, he worked and worked these songs. And, of course, he had all those years in the big bands with the Harry James Orchestra and Tommy Dorsey Orchestra and On the Road. So much like the Beatles in their years and performing in Germany and such, you know, they built up their 10,000 hours and became, you know, remarkably proficient and skillful at what they did before they even hit superstardom. And in a way, you can sort of say Sinatra was kind of there first doing that kind of same thing.
You know, I used to do this thing on the show where I'd ask people what their favorite Sinatra song is, and I realized you can't really do that with one song, so you have to have five, I guess, your five favorite Sinatra songs. And I've never talked to a real Sinatra fan who's had My Way on their list.
I mean, it's. I think Frank wasn't even that thrilled by it at the beginning, but of course, it became so popular, he included it in his later concerts, and at one point, I think he actually said it to an audience, okay, now it's time for the national anthem, and we're right into My Way.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't dislike My Way. I like it, you know, it's fine, but no, it wouldn't be in the top and list of my favorite Sinatra songs.
Yeah, if you could come up with a list, what would you have?
Oh, jeepers, the mix, you know, All or Nothing at All, In the Wee Small Hours of the Morning is hauntingly beautiful.
Oh, yeah, man.
You know, of course, One for My Baby and one more for The Road. I've Got the World on a String, Fly Me to the Moon.
Yeah.
His version of I've Got You Under My Skin, you know. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
You know, and some of his saloon songs, like Drinking Again, which is like...
wonderful song.
You know, One for My Baby, One more for The Road, you know, the Sinatra character is really suffering there. His heart is broken. But boy, Drinking Again, that's like 5:30 in the morning, and he is, you know, completely and utterly a devastated character. And so, also The Man That Got Away, his cover of that, which, of course, Judy Garland made famous in A Star Is Born, 1954, The Man That Got Away, and then Sinatra did his version of The Gal That Got Away, and that's, I think, equally as good as what Garland did, and I'm a huge Garland fan.
Yeah. And he married that with It Never Entered My Mind, which is just beautiful.
Oh, yeah, I know that whole segue into the one song, into the other, and coming back to The Gal That Got Away. Holy smokes, that's a piece of work.
Yeah.
But, you know, Sinatra also, he had impeccable taste in music for the most part, and also his arrangers were brilliant. You know, Nelson Riddle, Gordon Jenkins, Billy May, Quincy Jones. You know, he just worked with the absolute... best, and that came out and stands the test of time.
And what I liked about, because we've got the live recordings as well, and he always acknowledges not just and just as important, say, as the person who wrote the music and the lyrics, the arranger.
Yeah, well, that's the ultimate respect, isn't it? So Sinatra was smart and respectful, you know, always acknowledging songwriters and the arrangers all throughout his life. So, in fact, that's what I'm doing, too, in my show. So each of the songs I'm acknowledging you know, who wrote it or who may have originally performed the song, and as best as I can, the arranger. So something even like One for My Baby and More for My Road, which I'm going to be showing a clip from a late 50s television special, that song was first introduced by Fred Astaire in a musical called The Sky's the Limit. So not a lot of people know that, but, you know, I think that's all worthy information that I'm bringing out of my show.
And another thing, because you're such a Sinatra fan, I mean, Watertown, that album, yay or nay?
It's all right. I'd have to have another listen to it again, but it's not in my, you know, top five Sinatra albums, but there's some interesting tracks on there.
Yeah, I walked into Pulp Fiction Books on Main and Broadway in the summertime. And it came on, I guess the person behind the desk played it. And I never liked that record, that album, because I thought it was kind of weird.
Yeah.
But that first record of Watertown, man, it got me listening to it again.
Oh,
and I still don't like it, but, I mean, it's just amazing to hear him, because it's a real performance.
Well, yeah. Well, that's it. I mean, you know, sometimes it'll happen where maybe the material might not be up to snuff, but, you know, it's the singer that, you know, stands way above that, which is kind of the opposite of somebody like Rod Stewart, you know, who I like as a rock and roll artist, fair enough, but when he did his Great American Songbook albums, man, he can't handle it. I mean, I know they were super popular, they sold a lot, but if I hear it on a radio, I have to run across the room to turn the radio off. I mean, it's like I said about Garth Brooks performing The Lady is a Tramp, you know, okay, he's singing the words, but he's missing the meanings and the phrasing, and his voice just doesn't cut it for the Great American Songbook.
It reminds me of that Mark Twain line, you know the words, but you don't know the tune.
Right.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned the Rod Stewart thing, because it came on the radio. I was in a restaurant or something, like a Subway or something, and it was a duet with him and Cher, and I couldn't tell which of the two, you know, which was Cher and which was Rod Stewart. So, but anyway, what's this event on I called it Singing in the Dark, but it's not called that. What is it called?
Pardon me, on Monday the 20th, December 20th.
Sunday the 20th,
theater,
yeah.
Singing in the Dark. It is Singing in the Dark. And it's a variation on my popular series called Dancing in the Dark, in which I presented great dance numbers from the movie. So this one, as the title suggests, is great song numbers from narrative movies. And it's going to be the same format as my Dancing in the Dark series and the Sinatra Celebration, where I will introduce a block of clips, and in this case, each block of clips I'm running has a particular theme to it, and these are all just vocal performances, song performances from movies going back to the 1930s, and because it is, of course, Christmas time, there is one block in it that features classic Christmas songs that were first introduced in the movies as well. So it's a great way for audiences to see some of these legendary singers like Judy Garland and Fred Astaire and Dean Martin, and yes, Frank does make an appearance in this show, Doris Day, and I have some surprise appearances by actors and actresses as well in this, to see them on the big screen and to hear it with big sound and get a little information about them as well.
I'm going to guess what your favorite Christmas carol is, and Christmas song, I should say, and would that be Judy Garland and Mean St. Louis singing
Have yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Yeah, I guess it's right up there. I mean, I don't know if I could pick one, but yeah, I suppose I'd be in the top two or three. But yeah, that's a remarkable performance. And that song, of course, written for the movie and first introduced there, you know, it's got such longevity, that tune. And, of course, Garland was the perfect woman to introduce it because of that innate vulnerability in her. And it's sadness, and really within the context of the movie in St. Louis directed by Vincent Minnelli, it's a sad moment when she sings that song for several reasons. And, you know, it's a song that, of course, has been reinterpreted and covered by so many artists over the years. But, yeah, that's one of my favorites,
yeah.
Sure, absolutely.
And when you hear her do it, I mean, it's enough to make you weep, isn't it?
Yes, well, I have a very good friend of mine who's going to be attending both my Sinatra and Singing in the Dark show. His name's Jeff Smarden, and he just adores Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, and anytime he sees the movie, or even if he just hears Judy Garland sing it, you know, it brings him to tears. Sorry about that, Jeff. I had to break that news.
Michael, thanks for this. It's good talking again, and these shows that you put on are just they're very popular, and I can't wait for the Sinatra one.
Yeah, well, I hope to see you there, and again, people, then who knows, maybe I can repeat the Sinatra show or certainly do a Singing in the Dark part two. But it looks like in 2016, it looks very likely I'll be putting on Dancing in the Dark part three and Real Jazz part two, as I put on a similar show about jazz performances in the movies last June. And so it's so popular, probably I'm going to be doing a second one in 2016. So there you go.
Yeah, all the best for Happy Christmas and a swell New Year, Michael.
Yeah, same to you. Merry Christmas to you, Joe. Thanks very much, and Merry Christmas to everyone out there in Radio Land.
Michael Vandenbos joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.